What happens in Central America doesn't always stay in Central America. It also has an impact here in the United States. And that's where we start things today on the show, specifically how gang violence in El Salvador has repercussions here in the U.S. That violence has pushed many Salvadorans to flee their country and come north, or to send their children alone on that journey to the U.S.-Mexico border. A huge factor behind all this are the street gangs in El Salvador and the unraveling of a truce between the country's two main gangs. That's led to a new spike in El Salvador's murder rate. And the current government has responded by arresting several people who were involved in, get this, negotiating that truce back in 2012. Sounds crazy, right? More on that in a moment. First, let's go back a few years to hear what it was like when rival gang members actually agreed to sit face-to-face to make a deal.
These guys have attacked each other's families, and some of the crimes are absolutely horrific. So you can imagine the reluctance to get into the same room together.
That's Adam Blackwell, a former official with the Organization of American States, the OAS. He worked with the committee that guaranteed the truce.
These guys are, hated each other. Just getting them in the same room, despite the odio, as we say in Spanish, or the absolute palpable hatred, I think is one of the positive steps, getting them to look each other in the eye and realize that the level of barbarity had to stop.
Tell us about one of those moments where, people who hated each other sat down in the same room. You were there. What was that like?
It was frightening, frankly. We were in this prison room, and you had these guys who, frankly, don't look like somebody you'd want to have tea with. And, they were shaking their fist at each other. They wouldn't address each other by names. It was high, very tense. But calmer heads prevailed. And I think this is one of the lasting successes of this process, is that we were able to get them together. Could probably do so again if called upon.
Well, now El Salvador's government's going after the same people who brokered the truce. I mean, that sounds crazy. Why is that happening?
I don't think there's any other, reason other than political. These folks working with me, well-intentioned, most of them fairly low to mid-level bureaucrats, I can assure you didn't break any laws in front of me or with me. We were just trying in a situation with high moral hazard to bring peace.
So now El Salvador's government has issued arrest warrants for 21 people who participated in negotiating the truce. Who are these 21 people?
Well, you've got Raul Mujango, who's the figurehead of this group. He's one of the core mediators, a former guerrilla FMLN member. The others are mostly former prison managers or even some of the psychotherapists who are trying to deal with some of the behavior issues. So it's a fairly eclectic group. As I said earlier, a sort of mid to lower level bureaucrats, which indicates to me that they're just trying to look for scapegoats and not come after me or the 11 mayors of the municipalities that were involved or the ministers who were involved or any of the other sort of senior political figures.
Do you think the truce gave gangs legitimacy they didn't deserve, blurring the lines between authorities and criminals?
Oh, that's been one of the common criticisms. I mean, I think the gangs had legitimacy before. They grew up in Los Angeles. They were deported back. They formed in El Salvador and other countries of Central America. They have their own recruiting mechanism, their own culture, their own discipline, their own sense of identity. Political parties and others had tried to negotiate with them in the past. So what we were doing really wasn't new or giving them any broader exposure than it had in the past. What we did do that was different was getting them all together in the same place and trying to find a parallel process for each of the gangs. So, I don't buy that. I think, they're almost 10% of the El Salvadorian population if you think of their families and the multiplier. So, these are a serious chunk of the population at any stage.
So, Adam Blackwell, what is the way out of this? I mean, how do you come to a solution to the violence in El Salvador?
Well, I think this should be a call to all of us in the United States and, the international community in general to try and find strategies to stop what is essentially a civil war in El Salvador. I mean, 100 homicides over 100,000 makes El Salvador the most violent place on the planet, not called Syria. I would think something very helpful would be to stop deportations. I think this country is much better able to deal with violent gang members than El Salvador right now. And how much more El Salvador can take, how many more kids have to leave, how many more kids have to die or families be displaced, I don't know before the government and civil society and citizens in general will try something new.
Adam Blackwell, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Adam Blackwell is a former official with the Organization of American States. He worked on the committee that guaranteed El Salvador's gang truce. As I mentioned earlier, threats from gangs are sending record numbers of Salvadoran teens and their families fleeing north, seeking safety here in the U.S. Salvadoran American Susan Cruz helps youth on the run from gangs in Central America build new lives in this country. Decades ago, Cruz herself was in one of those gangs. She says they have a long reach that extends even to those who've managed to flee to the United States.
Social media, the use of cell phones, that has really facilitated communication and made it real time. And when they come to the United States, there's always a way, you know, to be found. Unfortunately, unless someone can be in a situation that's similar to a witness protection program, a lot of the kids or their families who were being extorted or threatened are sometimes found here in the United States as well.
So say a kid from Central America gets to a town or a city here in the U.S. How are they going to know if there is a gang after them in this new place they're living in?
For example, we've had situations where asylees or asylee applicants in the United States stay in communication with family members in their home country or people that they know, and that's how they are found. I've had a situation with a young man who stayed in communication with his younger sister, and through her friends at school, they found him here in the United States, and they attempted to extort him again.
So let me get back. This kid arrives in the U.S. How do they know that gang is in the town they just settled in?
Immigrant communities tend to be pretty well connected, especially when it comes to kids. They arrive at a school. Immediately, all the other kids want to know who he or she is. Hmm. And they start cross-referencing by cell phone numbers. You can look up someone's Facebook profile with their cell phone number alone. And so through the history of whatever activity they've had on social media, it's very easy to find people. And one of the things that I do with folks who are newly arrived, I basically do a very quick introduction to privacy settings and also about how much information they should or should not disclose so they are not found.
Yeah, kids who don't know that, though, must be really scared that they might be found, like too scared to even leave their house or go to school.
I think here in the United States, the biggest fear kids have is really with law enforcement because they seem to think that a police officer is the same as an immigration officer.
Susan, tell us the story of one teen that you've been working with recently who is really illustrative of what's going on.
This is a teenage girl who was being persecuted by local gang members in a town in El Salvador. She was left behind by her parents with a grandmother. And she was attending school, doing her thing. And by the time she turned 12, a local gang member took interest in her and started trying to romance her and, you know, wanted her to be his girlfriend. She turned him down and he became more aggressive about it. He basically told her, "You're going to be mine and no one else's." And he kept pursuing her and pursuing her until he was able to almost sexually assault her when she was walking home from school. She stopped going to school. Then paper notes with threats were slid under her grandmother's door. And this girl was terrified. She couldn't leave. Her grandmother was too old really to do anything. So she was basically sent by her family. And she came into the United States. She was apprehended at the border. She passed a credible fear interview, and she's now fighting her case in court. She's applying for asylum. The gang members have gone to the grandmother's house asking about the girl. And they've also indicated that for the grandmother to be okay, that someone's going to have to pay for her safety. Wow. So it's a situation that even if the kids leave, they have survivor's guilt when other relatives are left behind who are still facing threats of violence.
Could that girl be the recipient of a text or Facebook message, like, "We know where you are"?
She was able to really keep her privacy settings, that she only connected with people that were trustworthy. And even then, people approached them asking about the girl's whereabouts. So it became known that the girl was in the United States. However, they have not been able to reach her. What they have been trying to do is they have tried, you know, to pressure the grandmother to pay an extortion fee for her safety.
Susan, you know these networks from the inside. How can we diminish the hold of the gangs on young people?
By giving them the opportunities that the gangs give them. Unfortunately, the governments of these countries don't see that. Gangs take the place of family, and gangs fill society's voids. And until these governments and society in general, particularly society that lives in middle and upper class neighborhoods who don't feel affected by this, until they provide those opportunities to those kids that need them, and they treat them like family, and they give them the hope and the sense of safety and belonging, you know, that these kids need, the gangs are just going to keep on continuing filling those voids.
Salvadoran American Susan Cruz helps youth on the run from gangs in Central America build new lives here in the U.S. Susan, good to speak with you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.